In return, she gave the merchant a silver medallion from her belt. That was how it was done among the Dothraki. A bird seller taught a green and red parrot to say her name, and Danny laughed again, yet still refused to take him. What would she do with a green and red parrot in a Kalasar? She did take a dozen flasks of scented oils, the perfumes of her childhood. She had only to close her eyes and sniff them, and she could see the big house with the red door once more. When Doria looked longingly at a fertility charm, at a magician's booth, Danny took that too and gave it to the handmaiden, thinking that now she should find something for Iri and Jikri as well. Turning a corner, they came upon a wine merchant, offering thimble-sized cups of his wares to the passers-by. "Sweet reds!" he cried in fluent Dothraki. "I have sweet reds from Lys and Volantis and the Arbor. Whites from Lys, Tyroshi pear brandy, fire wine, pepper wine, the pale green nectars of myrrh, smokeberry browns and Andalis sours. I have them, I have them." He was a small man, slender and handsome, his flaxen hair curled and perfumed after the fashion of Lys. When Danny paused before his stall, he bowed low. "A taste for the Khaleesi. I have a sweet red from Dawn, my lady. It sings of plums and cherries and rich dark oak. A cask, a cup, a swallow. One taste, and you will name your child after me." Danny smiled. "My son has his name. But I will try your summer wine," she said in Valyrian. Valyrian as they spoke it in the Free Cities. The words felt strange on her tongue after so long. "Just a taste, if you'll be so kind." The merchant must have taken her for Dothraki, with her clothes and her oiled hair and sun-browned skin. When she spoke, he gaped at her in astonishment. "My lady, you are Tyroshi? Can it be so?" "My speech may be Tyroshi, and my garb Dothraki, but I am of Westeros, of the Sunset Kingdoms," Danny told him. Doria stepped up beside her. "You have the honour to address Daenerys of the House Targaryen, Daenerys Stormborn, Khaleesi of the Riding Men, and Princess of the Seven Kingdoms." The wine merchant dropped to his knees. "Princess!" he said, bowing his head. "Rise," Danny commanded him. "I would still like to taste that summer wine you spoke of." The man bounded to his feet. "That Dornish swill, it is not worthy of a princess. I have a dry red from the arbor, crisp and delectable. Please, let me give you a cask." Khal Drogo's visits to the Free Cities had given him a taste for good wine, and Danny knew that such a noble vintage would please him. "You honour me, sir," she murmured sweetly. "The honour is mine." The merchant rummaged about in the back of his stall and produced a small oaken cask. Burned into the wood was a cluster of grapes. "The red wine sigil," he said, pointing, "for the arbour. There is no finer drink. Khal Drogo and I will share it together. Ego, take this back to my litter, if you'll be so kind." The wine seller beamed as the Dothraki hefted the cask. She did not realize that Ser Jorah had returned until she heard the knight say, "No!" His voice was strange, brusque. "Aego, put down that cask." Aego looked at Danny. She gave a hesitant nod. "Ser Jorah, is something wrong?"
"I have a thirst. Open it, wine seller."
The merchant frowned.
"The wine is for the Khaleesi. Not for the likes of you, sir."
Ser Jorah moved closer to the stall.
"If you don't open it, I'll crack it open with your head."
He carried no weapons here, in the sacred city, save his hands. Yet his hands were enough, big, hard, dangerous, his knuckles covered with coarse, dark hairs. The wine seller hesitated a moment, then took up his hammer and knocked the plug from the cask.
"Pour,"
Ser Jorah commanded. The four young warriors of Danny's cars arrayed themselves behind him, frowning, watching with their dark almond-shaped eyes. "It would be a crime to drink this richer wine without letting it breathe." The wine-seller had not put his hammer down. Jogo reached for the whip, coiled at his belt, but Danny stopped him, with a light touch on the arm. "Do as Sir Jorah says," she said. People were stopping to watch. The man gave her a quick, sullen look. "As the princess commands." He had to set aside his hammer to lift the cask. He filled two thimble-sized tasting cups, pouring so deftly he did not spill a drop. Sir Jorah lifted a cup and sniffed at the wine, frowning. "Sweet, isn't it?" the wine-seller said, smiling. "Can you smell the fruit, sir? The perfume of the arbor? Taste it, my lord, and tell me it isn't the finest, richest wine that's ever touched your tongue." Sir Jorah offered him the cup. "You taste it first." "Me?" the man laughed. "I'm not worthy of this vintage, my lord, and it's a poor wine merchant who drinks up his own wares." His smile was amiable, yet she could see the sheen of sweat on his brow. "You will drink," Danny said, cold as ice. "Empty the cup, or I will tell them to hold you down while Sir Jorah pours a whole cask down your throat." The wine seller shrugged, reached for the cup, and grabbed the cask instead, flinging it at her with both hands. Sir Jorah bawled into her, knocking her out of the way. The cask bounced off his shoulder and smashed open on the ground. Danny stumbled and lost her feet. "No," she screamed, thrusting her hand out to break her fall, and Daria caught her by the arm and wrenched her backwards, so she landed on her legs and not her belly. The trader vaulted over the stall, darting between Ego and Rakharo. Quaro reached for an arak that was not there, as the blond man slammed him aside. He raced down the aisle. Danny heard the snap of Jogo's whip, saw the leather lick out and coil around the wine-seller's leg. The man sprawled face-first in the dirt. A dozen caravan guards had come running. With them was the master himself, merchant captain Bayam Vartiris, a diminutive Norvashi, with skin like old leather and a bristling blue mustachio that swept up to his ears. He seemed to know what had happened without a word being spoken. "Take this one away to await the pleasure of the cow," he commanded, gesturing at the man on the ground. Two guards hauled the wine-seller to his feet. "His goods I gift to you as well, princess," the merchant captain went on. "Small token of regret that one of mine would do this thing." Doria and Jiqui helped Danny back to her feet. The poison wine was leaking from the broken cask into the dirt. "How did you know?" she asked Sir Jorah, trembling. "How?"
"I did not know, Khaleesi, not until the man refused to drink. But once I read Magister Illyria's letter, I feared."
His dark eyes swept over the faces of the strangers in the market.
"Come, best not to talk of it here."
Danny was near tears as they carried her back. The taste in her mouth was one she had known before. Fear. For years, she had lived in terror of Viserys, afraid of waking the dragon. This was even worse. It was not just for herself that she feared now, but for her baby. He must have sensed her fright, for he moved restlessly inside her. Danny stroked the swell of her belly gently, wishing she could reach him, touch him, soothe him.
"You are the blood of the dragon, little one," she whispered, as her litter swayed along, curtains drawn tight. "You are the blood of the dragon, and the dragon does not fear."
Under the hollow hummock of earth that was her home in Vaes Dothrak, Danny ordered them to leave her, all but Sir Jorah. "Tell me," she commanded, as she lowered herself onto her cushions, "was it the usurper?"
"Yes," the knight drew out a folded parchment. "A letter to Viserys from Magister Illyrio.
Robert Baratheon offers lands and lordships for your death, or your brother's.
My brother?
Her sob was half a laugh.
He does not know yet, does he?
The usurper owes Drogo a lordship.
This time, her laugh was half a sob.
She hugged herself protectively.
And me, you said? Only me?
You and the child,
Ser Jorah said, grim.
No, he cannot have my son.
She would not weep, she decided. She would not shiver with fear.
The usurper has woken the dragon now, she told herself,
and her eyes went to the dragon's eggs, resting in their nest of dark velvet. The shifting lamplight limned their stony scales, and shimmering motes of jade and scarlet and gold swam in the air around them, like courtiers around a king.
Was it madness that seized her then, born of fear? Or some strange wisdom buried in her blood?
Danny could not have said. She heard her own voice saying, Ser Jorah, light the brazier.
Khaleesi?
The knight looked at her strangely.
It is so hot, are you certain?
She had never been so certain.
Yes, I have a chill. Light the brazier.
He bowed.
As you command.
When the coals were afire, Danny sent Ser Jorah from her. She had to be alone to do what she must do.
This is madness, she told herself, as she lifted the black and scarlet egg from the velvet. It will only crack and burn, and it's so beautiful. Ser Jorah will call me a fool if I ruin it.
And yet, cradling the egg with both hands, she carried it to the fire and pushed it down amongst the burning coals. The black scales seemed to glow as they drank the heat. Flames licked against the stone with small red tongues. Danny placed the other two eggs beside the black one in the fire. As she stepped back from the brazier, the breath trembled in her throat. She watched until the coals had turned to ashes. Drifting sparks floated up and out of the smoke hole. Heat shimmered in waves around the dragon's eggs. And that was all.
Your brother Rhaegar was the last dragon,
Ser Jorah had said.
Danny gazed at her egg sadly.
What had she expected?
1,000 years ago, they had been alive, but now they were only pretty rocks. They could not make a dragon. A dragon was air and fire, living flesh, not dead stone.
The brazier was cold again by the time Khal Drogo returned. Khalo was leading a pack horse behind him, with the carcass of a great white lion slung across its back. Above, the stars were coming out. The Khal laughed as he swung down off his stallion and showed her the scars on his legs where the Racha had raked him through his leggings.
I shall make you a cloak of its skin, moon of my life, he swore.
When Danny told him what had happened at the market, all laughter stopped, and Khal Drogo grew very quiet.
This poisoner was the first, Ser Jorah Mormont warned him, but he will not be the last. Men will risk much for a lordship.
Drogo was silent for a time. Finally he said,
This cellar of poisons ran from the moon of my life. Better he should run after her. So he will. Jorah, Jorah the Andal, to each of you I say, choose any horse you wish for my herds, and it is yours. Any horse save my red and the silver that was my bride gift to the moon of my life. I make this gift to you for what you did. And to Rhaegar, son of Drogo, the stallion who will mount the world, to him I also pledge a gift
To him I will give this iron chair his mother's father sat in. I will give him 7 kingdoms. I, Drogo Karl, will do this thing.
His voice rose, and he lifted his fist to the sky.
I will take my Khalasar west to where the world ends and ride the wooden horses across the black salt sea as no Karl has done before. I will kill the men in the iron suits and tear down their stone houses. I will rape their women, take their children as slaves, and bring their broken gods back to Vesdethrak, to bow down beneath the mother of mountains. This I vow, I, Drogo, son of Barbo, this I swear before the mother of mountains, as the stars look down in witness.
His Khalasar left Vesdethrak 2 days later, striking south and west across the plains. Khal Drogo led them on his great red stallion, with Daenerys beside him on her silver. The wine seller hurried behind them, naked, on foot, chained at throat and wrist. His chains were fastened to the halter of Dany's silver. As she rode, he ran after her, barefoot and stumbling. No harm would come to him, so long as he kept up. Catelyn. It was too far to make out the banners clearly, but even through the drifting fog she could see that they were white, with a dark smudge in the center that could only be the direwolf of Stark, grey upon its icy field. When she saw it with her own eyes, Catelyn reined up her horse and bowed her head in thanks. The gods were good. She was not too late. "They await our coming, milady," Sir Willis Manderly said, "as my lord father swore they would."
"Let us not keep them waiting any longer, sir."
Sir Brynden Tully put the spurs to his horse and trotted briskly toward the banners. Catelyn rode beside him. Sir Willis and his brother Sir Wendell followed, leading their levies, near 1,500 men, some 20-odd knights and as many squires, 200 mounted lancers, swordsmen and free riders, and the rest foot, armed with spears, pikes, and tridents. Lord Wyman had remained behind to see to the defences of White Harbour. A man of near 60 years, he had grown too stout to sit a horse.
"If I had thought to see war again in my lifetime, I should have eaten a few less eels," he'd told Catelyn when he met her ship, slapping his massive belly with both hands. His fingers were fat as sausages. "My boys will see you safe to your son there. Have no fear."
His boys were both older than Catelyn, and she might have wished that they did not take after their father quite so closely. Sir Willis was only a few eels short of not being able to mount his own horse. She pitied the poor animal. Sir Wendell, the younger boy, would have been the fattest man she had ever known, had she only neglected to meet his father and brother. Willis was quiet and formal, Wendell loud and boisterous. Both had ostentatious, walrus moustaches and heads as bare as a baby's bottom. Neither seemed to own a single garment that was not spotted with food stains. Yet she liked them well enough. They had gotten her to rob, as their father had vowed, and nothing else mattered. She was pleased to see that her son had sent eyes out even to the east. The Lannisters would come from the south when they came, but it was good that Rob was being careful. "My son is leading a host to war," she thought, still only half believing it. She was desperately afraid for him, and for Winterfell. Yet she could not deny feeling a certain pride as well. A year ago, he had been a boy.
What was he now, she wondered. Outriders spied the Manderley banners, the white merman with trident in hand rising from the blue-green sea, and hailed them warmly. They were led to a spot of high ground, dry enough for a camp. Sir Willis called a halt there and remained behind with his men to see the fires laid and the horses tended, while his brother, Wendell, rode on with Catelyn and her uncle to present their father's respects to their liege lord. The ground under their horses' hooves was soft and wet. It fell away slowly beneath them, as they rode past smoky peat fires, lines of horses and wagons heavy laden with hard bread and salt beef. On a stony outcrop of land, higher than the surrounding country, they passed a lord's pavilion with walls of heavy sailcloth. Catelyn recognized the banner, the bull moose of the Hornwoods, brown on its dark orange field. Just beyond, through the mists, she glimpsed the walls and towers of Moat Cailin, or what remained of them. Immense blocks of black basalt, each as large as a crofter's cottage, lay scattered and tumbled like a child's wooden blocks, half sunk in the soft, boggy soil. Nothing else remained of a curtain wall that had once stood as high as Winterfell's. The wooden keep was gone entirely, rotted away, 1,000 years past, with not so much as a timber to mark where it had stood. All that was left of the great stronghold of the first men were three towers, three where there had once been 20, if the tale-tellers could be believed. The gatehouse tower looked sound enough, and even boasted a few feet of standing wall to either side of it. The drunkard's tower, off in the bug where the south and west walls had once met, leaned like a man about to spew a bellyful of wine into the gutter, and the tall, slender children's tower, where legend said the children of the forest had once called upon their nameless gods to send the hammer of the waters, had lost half its crown. It looked as if some great beast had taken a bite out of the crenellations along the tower top and spit the rubble out across the bug. All three towers were green with moss. A tree was growing out between the stones on the north side of the gatehouse tower, its gnarled limbs festooned with ropey white blankets of ghost skin. "Gods have mercy!" Sir Brynden exclaimed when he saw what lay before them. "This is Moat Cailin? It's no more than a
death trap," Catelyn finished. "I know how it looks, Uncle. I thought the same the first time I saw it. But Ned assured me that this ruin is more formidable than it seems. The three surviving towers command the causeway from all sides, and any enemy must pass between them. The bugs here are impenetrable, full of quicksands and suckholes and teeming with snakes. To assault any of the towers, an army would need to wade through waist-deep black muck, cross a moat full of lizard lions, and scale walls slimy with moss, all the while exposing themselves to fire from archers in the other towers." She gave her uncle a grim smile. "And when night falls, there are said to be ghosts, cold, vengeful spirits of the north, who hunger for southern blood." Sir Brynden chuckled.
"Remind me not to linger here. Last I looked, I was a southern myself."
Standards had been raised atop all three towers. The Karstark sunburst hung from the drunkard's tower beneath the direwolf. On the children's tower, it was the great John's giant in shattered chains, but on the gatehouse tower, the Stark banner flew alone. That was where Rob had made his seat. Catelyn made for it, with Sir Brynden and Sir Wendell behind her, their horses stepping slowly down the log and plank road that had been laid across the green and black fields of mud. She found her son surrounded by his father's lord's bannermen, in a draughty hall
with a peat fire smoking in a black hearth. He was seated at a massive stone table, a pile of maps and papers in front of him, talking intently with Roose Bolton and the Great John.